Our third case for this morning is First Weber Group versus Jonathan Horsfall, 13-10-26. And we will hear first from Mr. Mormond. You can get a glass of water if you want.
We have these trick pictures just to fool the lawyers. It's part of the test we get. Pictures contain truth serum as well.
Mm-hmm. When everybody will witness, I'm drinking the entire glass.
All right.
OD.
So, you may proceed.
Good morning, Your Honors. Kim Mormon on behalf of First Weber. And I thank you for this opportunity to address this case. The facts of this case are undisputed. What the defendant, Mr. Horsfall, did is undisputed. The only question here has been what labels to apply to his actions. The facts have been undisputed from two different sources, the findings of a Wisconsin state court decision and the undisputed documentation submitted to the bankruptcy court on summary judgment.
So the real issue here, as I see it, is whether there is enough to show that he crossed the line between breaching various contracts and obligations, which he certainly did, over to the point of willful and malicious injury for purposes of 523A6, such that these would be non-dischargeable in bankruptcy.
That is correct.
And so let's start with the intentional interference with contract. That's one of the issues that's before the state court, right? Well, you have to behave intentionally. First Weber, of course, had a contract with a third party. He interferes. The interference was intentional. It caused damages. No privilege. But is intentional interference in this sense something that's the same as willful or malicious? That's where I'm not clear yet.
Well, there's two responses to that. One of them is background. It's difficult to discuss this case focusing on breach of contract when it's undisputed, and what the WRA would say and what I would gladly elaborate is in order to take these actions, it's not just breach of an agent agreement that he had with First Weber. It's not just, and I don't even know how it gets there. It's erroneous that the court describe it that way, a breach of a third-party contract, which is what they described it as. It's not that. It's interference with that, intentional.
Well, First Weber has an arrangement with Call, right, and the Acostas are protected buyers.
Yes.
Vis-a-vis that arrangement. So I know that there are multiple moving parts here, but I actually had a factual question for you. Is anywhere in the record, we looked and we couldn't find it, a copy of the HUD-1 form that accompanied the closing of that piece of property?
It should be, and I can find it if not.
I think it would be helpful to see the HUD-1 form, because in the HUD-1 form, those things are supposed to include all of the information about a closing.
What I can say is what's included in the HUD, and what this is reported in the briefing as well, is that they took the same HUD, from all appearances, that had been prepared for the original offer that got canceled, and simply they even forgot to erase the name of the prior would-be the cooperating broker and simply put in picket fence in place of First Weber.
So in other words, right, I mean, if there had been two brokers, then you'd see on the, I think it's part 7 of the form, you'd see two brokers' names. And the reason I'm interested in this is that one of the theories is that, which I suppose is probably true anyway as a matter of contract, that Mr. Horsfall wanted his $6,000, but he didn't mind at all if Mr. Call paid First Weber $9,600, right? That in other words, he just wanted his money. He really couldn't have cared less, and so wasn't willfully or maliciously preventing you from getting yours. But the HUD-1 form is supposed to show all disbursements at a closing.
Well, the starting point here is he did this without any authorization whatsoever. I think that's to be understood. First Weber had a listing contract with this person. Horsfall quits, and he has no entitlement to any commission under First Weber. And he
vis-a-vis the Acostas, he could have sold it to some stranger, right?
Under what theory? There, he has.
I thought that the listing contract for the Calls property terminated.
It was expired early, which
yeah,
means
it expired
that
early. So once it had expired, he was able to enter into a listing agreement that covered anybody except protected buyers, I thought.
Correct, but yeah. He did not do so.
I know, so that's why I bring the Acostas in.
Right. Well, no, but very important here is that Horsfall had no contract with the or no listing with Call after he left First Weber.
So you're using the word listing kind of with a capital L, right? You know, that there
yes.
isn't something that the Wisconsin real estate industry would have recognized as a listing. It's not an MLS. It's not, there's no written agreement.
It was none of that, but also it wouldn't be recognized by the state. The state has a statute that we cited that it has to be a written contract.
It has to be a written
with
yeah.
agency disclosure, or it is void. It doesn't exist. Very important here is one of the mistakes, I believe, where the bankruptcy court went off in the wrong direction on this case and decided incorrectly, was it because it thought there was some kind of entitlement that Horsfall had done the work, it sold the property, and without parsing through any of the details, even though we cited the details.
Right. Now, this is your argument that Wisconsin doesn't recognize quantum merit in these real estate
Absolutely.
Transactions?
Absolutely. Yeah. But anyhow, the court repeated, implicit on summary judgment and explicit in its trial decision, that Horsfall had entitlement. And there is none. The exclusivity of the contract, both by contract and by the law of Wisconsin, the brokerage law that we cited is completely undisputed, is he had no right to be engaged as a broker at all, and of course no right to get paid. So what he did is intentionally interfered with a contract, and in addition took money to which he had zero entitlement. The bankruptcy court, I think.
So why does that all add up? I really want to get back. This is a bankruptcy case. It's
yes.
not a contract case. So why does all of that add up to either willful or malicious behavior vis-a-vis your client?
Because this man is a professional broker. Part of applying 523A6, in my understanding, is to understand, let's do malice first because that's easy, is the conscious disregard of one's duties. I think the undisputed fact that he had no authorization under state law, broke state law, in addition
That's
to...
That's a 30-acre case, right? Among other things, in rate 30-acre.
Well, and there's several other Wilson and the other cases. Now, there are several other cases in there. The fact that he breached state law and code of ethics is undisputed, and I can go into details if you wish. But what that means, though, is he consciously disregarded his duties. He did these intentionally. This is a professional broker, not somebody just accidentally stumbling into the broker world and messing things up. He deliberately did that. There's evidence of concealment by not being in the MLS. And he never...
So are you equating knowledge that he was doing something wrong with willfulness?
I guess what I'm trying to say is we're not dealing with someone who made a mistake here and has never claimed a mistake. He's never claimed, oh, I was mistaken on this. This man, as a professional broker, deliberately broke all the rules that were applicable to that situation, as the Wisconsin Realtor Association has also outlined, with regard to each one of his actions. They were also all unethical. All that action intentional, very roughly applying these to 523A, intentional, and this I think is one of the analytical mistakes in the case, intentional interference with contract by itself may not equate to 523A6. And then they go, well, in conversion, or taking of money. I'd gladly go into conversion some more, but he took money that he had no entitlement to without authorization, and it necessarily injured First Weber. So, I mean, put those two, and they say conversion by itself may not necessarily do it. But
no, I thought you were arguing essentially that this was that he had a motive, or that his act was substantially certain result in injury
Absolutely.
To the original listing broker, which is First Weber.
When you combine the exclusivity that he has no right to be engaged in the transaction and no right to take money, that when he does take that money from that transaction, it necessarily injures the party to whom it is exclusively owed. And that's not just me arguing. That's the basis behind this is a state court judgment that recognized that listing contract and undisputed Wisconsin brokerage law that he cannot do what he did.
I guess it was Call who was the seller. Wasn't he the seller?
Call was a seller.
I thought I saw somewhere in transcript where he testified that this was an understanding that this was going to be a lot less costly to Call.
Yes.
He engaged in this transaction outside of the other one. Did he testify to that? I don't remember.
Yes. Well, what had happened is the bankruptcy court decided to favor Horsfall over Call, didn't like Call. But in my point of view, it's irrelevant given the undisputed law that's at issue.
Did Call say what Judge Mannion just asked?
If I understand you, what Call testified to is that Horsfall told him, I can do it cheaper than First Weber, and did it for $6,000.
And the bankruptcy court in general does not credit Call?
It seemed not to credit for several reasons that I've disputed. I mean, they don't seem to be fair attributions, but and irrelevant, essentially. But Horsfall had a duty at that point when he's meeting Call. We've already established, I hope for purposes of this discussion here, he had no right under state law to be involved. And as a broker collecting commission, that's his only right to engage in that behavior, is to comply with the law. It was unethical. When he met Call, Call said, Horsfall, his friend, Jonathan, told me I can do it cheaper, and don't worry, you know, it's all taken care of with First Weber. So basically, he's hiding the fact that what he admitted to us all later is that Call still owes the full commission to First Weber. So he hid that from his friend.
Wouldn't that have had to show up on the HUD-1? If that was part of the distribution of the sale proceeds, it seems like every time I've bought a house, you know, you have a little line that says how much somebody's going to pay the broker.
But the HUD, and I believe it's in the record, but it says only the picket fence was paid.
Right, and that's why I'm saying if there's concealment, then that would tend to support what Call was saying.
Yes. Well, I mean, that's exactly what happened. That fact's not disputed, HUD or no HUD. But important here, though, is what Horsfall would have to do if he's actually operating as a broker and actually was negligent in some way, which he does not even claim, is he would have needed to instruct Call as to what the situation. The bankruptcy court saw this as a contradiction, but Call said that he told me he could do it cheaper and, you know, just go with him. What Horsfall said is he didn't address the subject at all. That in itself is a violation. The fact he's operating as a listing and writing on the offer that he's a dual agent when he has no contract with either one of them, they must be in writing. He's given no agency disclosures. This is all in breach of all the law and ethics that are applicable to the situation, and he's a professional. And then to say that I let this guy, and his affidavit and everything else is clear, I knowingly took $6,000 to which I had no entitlement and left this guy on the hook for $9,600 more. This is not a knowing breach of contract. This is a renegade conduct as the Wisconsin Realtors Association referred to it correctly. I mean, he's running roughshod over all of the applicable rules and regulations in addition to breaching a contract with us. In addition to interfering with a third-party contract, and one key piece here, I believe, that led the bankruptcy court astray, is it erroneously stated on summary judgment as a would-be fact that Horsfall listed the property in an official sense, is the only way to use the word, after he terminated First Weber, but we know he did not. Horsfall had never claimed to any court, not the state court, not the bankruptcy court, not in any statements, not in any submissions of any kind, to have listed the property. Only after that point, obviously prompted by the bankruptcy court's mistake, did they then go on to tentatively claim at trial, well, you know, maybe I did list it, but I'm not sure, and then had to concede there was no written listing, which under Wisconsin law means no listing.
Okay, what about credibility as far as what I guess he testified at the bankruptcy court? The bankruptcy court seems to have believed him that he didn't really do all this, I guess, maliciously. Is there a problem there as far as we have to review credibility?
No, two reasons. Number one, the credibility determinations are linked specifically to a couple of pieces that are completely irrelevant. General statement that he didn't display any ill will towards First Weber, but we don't need to prove that. That's not necessary. And that he credibly intended, or wished, that the original transaction would have closed. Well, that's nice. That's historical. It's completely way before all the things he did deliberately that were wrongful.
Okay. You have a minute left, just so that you know.
The other part of it is that the credit. My position is that the completely. There's no authority whatsoever that I've seen here, and I've had to look a lot into issue preclusion, and none cited by either court, and certainly none by our opponent, to say in any way justify tossing issue preclusion out the window and forcing us to relitigate all facts on a document-intensive case where the basic facts are undisputed, and even if they're confusing at times, all the references to the documents and the law and the contracts, the state-mandated forms where state this stuff are out there, there's no basis for them to do this. The I suppose I should save the rest for rebuttal.
But you better save if you want anything. So
thank you.
Sure. Mr. Winnig.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Joel Winnig. I'm a sole practitioner in Madison, Wisconsin, and I represent Jonathan Horsfall. It's an honor to appear before this court. It's been a long time since I've been here. It goes back to when I used to do appointed criminal defense in the district court, and I had one occasion to appeal here. And I know I'll never appear before a higher court because I don't try to take complicated cases. I help people, individuals, and small businesses with personal and financial problems. That's how Mr. Horsfall came to me to deal with the problem that Mr. Mormon and his firm, First Weber, had obtained a state court judgment against him when he was unrepresented and he lost the case on summary judgment pro se. At the time he came to me, he was still in the real estate business. He had a commission that was being garnished. I filed hundreds, probably thousands of bankruptcies. That's a big part of what I've done, and I think it's an important part of what an individual lawyer can do to help implement the policies that Congress has created that give honest debtors a fresh start. Mr. Horsfall was an honest debtor.
So he certainly was honestly in debt. But, you know, the question here, though, given the findings in the state court, and there's no rule that summary judgments are, I don't know why this came up in this case, but summary judgments are a perfectly respectable way and indeed a very common way to resolve cases. So he breached a lot of contracts. He breached a lot of agreements, and we need to decide whether those breaches are willful or malicious for purposes of 526A6, or whether they're just plain old garden variety breaches of duty that can be discharged by a bankruptcy proceeding. That's the only question. We are not here to make judgments about the rest of the world, you know, whether there should be a bankruptcy system or not or anything else. And I have to say, I mean, I'm very troubled by what Mr. Horsfall did, and it seems to me that he very clearly left the impression with the calls that they could sell this property at a bargain price, $6,000 in commission, avoid First Weber altogether, which they managed to do for quite some number of years. And, you know, to come in now and say, oh, you know, it was certainly fine for calls to have to pay. Of course, the calls have since declared bankruptcy, too, so there's no money anywhere. But pay the extra $9,600 to First Weber strikes me as, you know, pretty bad to start with.
Well, I understand, but your question, Your Honor, is, if you have that premise, then anybody who incurred debt on a charge card and discharged it in bankruptcy wouldn't be
not
ideal
at all.
Behavior.
Only but somebody who concealed it from someone else and who maliciously, you know, misrepresents what's going on. That's why I'm interested in the HUD-1 form. I want to know, was First Weber's interest disclosed?
And there are all these other requirements as a realtor that he's educated about and committed to by the agreements that he signed.
Well, I appreciate that, Your Honor. And I do have, I was able to find a reference in Judge Martin's decision. I don't have the record reference to it, but it was the April 26, 2011 decision after trial. And it refers to, on page 3, the settlement statement. And what he finds there is that Call had to pay over $19,000 in to the closing. So the question is,
but
these
what's
are
that, what's that pertain to? You know, you've probably looked at a million of these things too, and the total number doesn't tell me one way or the other. Actually, you know, six plus 9,600 may or may not have anything to do with that. There are often other charges that people have to pay in to discharge, say, an existing mortgage on a place. That was my understanding from Judge Martin's.
But this is what I'm trying to explain, Your Honor. We had to accept the state court judgment for what it was because you're correct on the summary judgment. That's a state court judgment.
That's the judgment. Okay. It's not a judgment of less worth.
But the question is, did that judgment determine the issue that was before Judge Martin and reviewed already by Judge Conley,
which was... That's a sub-question. There are two levels of this case. One of them is, you know, is there enough evidence for it to go forward to allow First Weber to show non-dischargeability? One source of that evidence might be some of the fact findings from the state court proceeding. It doesn't have to be all of them. On issue preclusion, we've got the same parties. We have some overlap of issues. It's not a perfect overlap. First Weber is probably going to have to prove more things than the state court established, but some of them should be off the table.
Well, the facts as they came out were that these are just allegations about what Mr. Horsfall's role was. He originally was working for First Weber, and he wanted
What's just an allegation?
Allegation that he didn't, number one, have any entitlement to the commission or that his work with Call didn't actually benefit First Weber.
At summary judgment, you've got to put the documents in the record, and he didn't.
Right, and that's why he lost on summary judgment.
But he hasn't. You haven't proffered anything even since then. You haven't suggested there's a single document to show why there was something unfair about the way the state court resolved the case.
Well,
I would think at least a proffer.
That wasn't necessary to do, Your Honor, because we defeated the issue of summary judgment in bankruptcy court, which then allowed Mr. Moorman the full opportunity to prove his case at trial. And the judge at trial specifically did not find that Mr. Horsfall intended any willful and malicious injury to First Weber.
But the question is, was the record properly constituted? I know what the bottom line was. You know, obviously, it's all right here in front of us. And what the bankruptcy court says, and everybody seems to be worrying about the fact that the ultimate issues of willfulness and malice weren't litigated in the state court, but that's not the way issue preclusion works in Wisconsin or anywhere else. There can be particular building blocks, if you will, factual building blocks that do get litigated.
Well, I think both judicial officers that looked at that, Your Honor, analyzed issue preclusion properly. They looked at the first prong of the test, and they both found that the precise issue was not tried and was not necessary to the determination.
I'm telling you that I think they were a little sloppy with what they identified as, quote, the precise issue. I have some concern about that, and we're here on review of those two courts, so we need to be satisfied.
I understand, and I understand your review of summary judgment is independent so that you don't have to give a determination to the way they looked at the law, but I believe they looked at the law correctly. Judge Martin did, and Judge Conley did as well. And there are two prongs to that test, Your Honor. And I submitted that the second prong was, and I think Judge Martin was very careful in his decision as well, saying you don't meet the first prong. But because he knows that this is subject to review and he's a careful jurist, he said, but even had you met that first prong, you wouldn't get past the second prong of the test. And there were five factors in
that. Do you have cases where Wisconsin courts refused to give issue preclusion when in the first proceeding the party proceeded pro se? And this wasn't a court of limited jurisdiction. There was certainly no reason why Mr. Horsfall had to proceed pro se. It was the Circuit Court of Dane County, as I recall, which is the court of general jurisdiction in Wisconsin.
That's correct.
So are there cases where Wisconsin courts say one of the circumstances in which we refuse to give issue preclusion under Part 2 is the pro se status of one of the litigants?
I can't say that I can recall that as being a factor out of any of the cases that I'm familiar with.
Well, I mean, that's important because I was actually quite surprised to see the Part 2 concern here.
My feeling about it was in terms of the fundamental fairness was if somebody knew that that was what they were litigating, they would have done differently.
The Supreme Court of the United States looks at issue preclusion quite differently. If you think of cases like Maurice or you think of It's even at the Park Lane hosiery offensive issue preclusion. They worry about the opportunities to have a full airing of an issue. Are there jurisdictional limitations? Did the first case involve very small stakes and the second case involve huge stakes? But the stakes haven't changed between these two cases. It's really just about the effect of the bankruptcy. It's not like the first case was for $100 and the second case was for $1 million. That in Park Lane hosiery would be a problem. But
well,
that's not your case.
Yes, but I believe that the main fact is if you were told in the underlying proceeding that the issue was you're being sued and this is for a debt that can never be discharged in bankruptcy, that somebody might have looked at that differently, because oftentimes there are people on their way to bankruptcy where the charge card company sues them and they get a judgment and they don't do anything about it until they're being garnished. So they always have trouble coming up with money for lawyers. So the question is, where in this panoply of events going back to 2002 should Mr. Horsfall have proceeded differently?
And the other question is, I see it. I mean, I think First Weber may be overstating it when they think the state court decision is the be-all and the end-all. It may well not be, as you're arguing. But I can't get over the thought that it provides some of the underlying facts, some but not all.
Well, that's true. But, I mean, the big mistake that I think that's being looked at is that this commission is, and it's been argued by First Weber and rejected by both judges, that it's a race. It's something that what happened here prevented Mr. Call from paying First Weber. In fact, it didn't. In fact, that's what I was saying. It helped him because when he cleared off his federal tax liens, his state tax liens, his first and second mortgage and got rid of this property and got rid of those payments, he wanted to get rid of that property. He couldn't do it earlier because he couldn't clear those liens and he had a dispute with the subcontractor. And that's all as found by the court. So, and what that did then is free Mr. Call of those obligations. He was still in business. He could have gone out and made money, and he could have paid First Weber if he wanted to. That
but
was
Mr.
his
Horsfall
obligation.
Mr. Horsfall never testifies that in order to use Mr. Horsfall's services, it's really going to be a $6,000 surcharge over the $9,600. He just testifies nothing was said. Is that correct?
I believe that was his testimony.
He never says, I said my $6,000 is extra.
I think what he generally said was he didn't recall the events because at that point they were 8 years old and he was trying to help his friend get rid of properties that his friends wanted to get rid of, and Judge Martin credited his testimony and found Mr. Call's testimony about all of that incredible. So he looked at it as his friend needed to dump a property because he would probably have lost it and he wouldn't have been able to get even that much for it. So he got rid of the property so he could go on with his life. That's not unusual at all. So
that there is something, looking at the amicus brief, there's something highly wrong and unusual about the way Mr. Horsfall went about it. Now, maybe he was a terrible broker and paid no attention to any of the things that he had just done 6 months earlier to get his broker's license, and he didn't remember a single thing. I don't know, but he did everything wrong.
Well, it's not an ideal course of conduct. I would not dispute that. And like many things, he wishes he would have done it differently. But the question before the court has always been, once we're in bankruptcy court, did he willfully and maliciously injure First Weber in doing what he did? And both a lot of that is based on a credibility determination that's uniquely the province of the district court with the bankruptcy judge. And the reason I've asked you to find that this appeal is frivolous is because when you read the briefs, they're just a rehashing of the same arguments that have been made.
That happens all the time. You're not even allowed to raise arguments on appeal in general if it hasn't been preserved below. In other words, presented the same argument below.
Well,
this appeal is not frivolous, however it comes out, one way or the other.
You're saying you've already made that determination?
You haven't persuaded me yet. I mean, I'm certainly happy to read everything again.
Well,
so I'm not ruling from the bench.
I have distinct difficulty with the concept of this as frivolous as well.
Well, I take that, Your Honor, as number one, the fact that I can't believe that any outside law firm would have been hired to do this for the stakes at question. and because I've read your cases, even yours, Judge Tinder, that you decided last month in Coney versus Cassidy. And the exact quote is, when an appeal rehashes positions that the district court properly rejected, or when it presents arguments that are lacking in substance and foreordained to lose, the appeal is frivolous. Now, I took that very seriously in looking at all the other cases that I cited in my brief, and these are the exact same arguments that Judge Conley rejected the district court, but the reason it's worse in this is this isn't just an appeal from the district court, it's an appeal from the bankruptcy court to the district court, and so those same arguments have now been made three times. If you see them differently than those other judicial officers, then there's nothing I can do about that, but there is a real victim here of the frivolous appeal because Mr. Horsfall was entitled to his bankruptcy discharge and fresh start 3 years ago, and the litigation here has exceeded the costs of what's been in question. So, you know, the fact that this dispute is over the small amount of money, and there's, in my view, there's no principle to be vindicated other than when you review it carefully.
Not from Mr. Horsfall's point of view, but there's a huge principle from First Weber's point of view, because they're repeat players. Mr. Horsfall is not.
Well, I understand that, Your Honor, but the facts of what Mr. Horsfall did and whether he willfully and maliciously injured them, that could happen again, but the question would be, if
what
you can't prove...
What Weber is interested in is people who sell properties without listings and people who don't disclose the chain of agency relationships. And that is, again, that's not Mr. Horsfall's concern. I'm sure his concern is just getting his discharge in bankruptcy. But on the other side of the case, and this often happens, the government is often a repeat player and the stakes look low, or... You know, McDonald's will be a repeat player and the stakes look low. Walmart's notorious for litigating in these kinds of situations where somebody just has a little slip and fall. So litigation happens for a lot of reasons.
Well, I appreciate that, Your Honor, and my time is up, but the quote that I have in my brief about Judge Easterbrook says it'd be, if you leave this with a Pyrrhic victory, that he was given his discharge in bankruptcy after defeating their summary judgment motion, after being successful at trial, after winning the appeal at the district court level, and if he wins the appeal here and you send him away with a completely Pyrrhic victory because he spent more defending that than the money that was involved, then that isn't a remedy, and that leaves him without any benefit, and it doesn't deter what, in my view, is a repetition before this court of the exact same arguments that were rejected twice below. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much. You have about a minute, Mr. Mormond.
7 in Afrin trial. I can go over that. If I might, I'll try to read as quickly as I can on this. The comment was made that he breached lots of agreements. He actually only breached one. He breached the agent agreement he had with First Weber. After that, all of his actions were contrary to state law. And I understand the...
Tell me again which exhibit the...
7 from trial. It was another comment as the extra $9,600. Very, very important here is the only commission allowable exclusivity, the only right to be engaged, the only right to collect it was the $9,600. And so the $600 is not a surcharge. It's just illegal. He has no basis to be here. I understand the idea that the state court judgment that there might be more, but I really don't think there is. But if there was more needed, it was completely undisputed in this entire case that he violated state law, Wisconsin brokerage laws, and the Code of Ethics. That's the plus. That confirms that he had no other, and he doesn't claim any other, basis to be doing this. He had no right at law. And that in order to go beyond this, go beyond that state law and see his views favorably under with regard to 523A6, it requires ignoring the violations of state law and the Code of Ethics, and ignoring what else he did in this case. He had no basis, and everything he did was if I might address two more quick subjects, or?
If you can do it in a sentence, I'll let you.
Mr. Horsfall, also, if it matters, was not pro se, and there is no authority comma.
Oh, you've mentioned that in your brief, so maybe we'll just take the case
under
advisement.
Fair enough. I believe the allegation that this is frivolous is itself frivolous.
Okay, you said that in your brief.
Thank you.
All right, thank you very much. The case is taken under advisement.